My name is Stephanie Grand, and I'm here to talk about the disturbance effect on soil carbonates. It's a rather new area of investigation for me. I'm used to working in acid forest soils where carbonates were just never a problem. But as we all know here, the soil carbon pool is a global important one. And one thing that we may not always think about, I never really thought about it all that much, is that globally one-third of this soil carbon pool is in the inorganic or carbonate form. And we mostly think about carbonate as being something of concern or importance in arid and semi-arid areas, but it turns out that in recently glaciated terrains where soils are developing on carbonaceous substrates, you can get carbonates in very humid areas, like where our study sites are. That's where the Red Star is in Escanaba. This is northern Michigan. And the soils are formed on limestone terrains. And so that's what the distribution of carbonates in the profile looks like. We have carbonate persisting well above the expected weathering front, and I'm suspecting that the critters that I have in the picture are responsible for this. So this graph basically just shows the depth distribution of the carbonates through the profile. I have the light blue line that is carbonates dissolved in 90 seconds, and then the dark blue line is total carbonates. We are measuring them on a pressure transducer, which allows us to see how fast they react in acid, which is kind of interesting. So anyway, we have fast-reacting carbonates even right in the topsoil, probably because of biological translocation to the A horizon. So keeping this in mind, that we have these carbonates in these soils, the objective of this study was to figure out what happened to these carbonates after disturbance, such as land use change. A hypothesis that we can formulate is that after soil disturbance, we might increase soil acidity, which could accelerate soil carbonate weathering rates and result in the emission of soil some of this carbonate carbon into CO2. So that's my hypothesis in the picture. We could think of this happening. So maybe after disturbance, we have an increase in nitrification rate, which releases protons. That could be strong acid weathering interacting with the carbonates in the soil profile, resulting in this carbonate-derived carbon efflux out of soil. So a little bit more on our disturbance. We have a great land use change experiment that was set up because of the sudden interest in growing biofuels in marginal land. So what happened is that we had these abandoned marginal agricultural land that had been under grass mixes undisturbed for several decades. And now they're getting tilled up and the poplar plantations are getting established. They're trying to grow these fast-growing poplar trees. This is just one growing season from the cutting to the end of the season where they're above your head. So that's our land use change experiment. And within this framework, we wanted to use the difference in natural abundance of C13 to differentiate between the organic and inorganic contributions to soil carbon emissions. So the nice thing about that is that in theory, we have a really wide separation between the isotopic signature of the carbonates, of the inorganic carbon, and of the organic matter. The organic matter of C3 plants being around minus 25 to minus 29 per mil relative to the PD belemnite. And the carbonates, if they're pure marine carbonates, they should sit around zero per mil. In the soil environment, they usually get a little depleted because they reprecipitate with organic biogenic sources of carbon. So their signature creeps up with time, can reach about minus 12 per mil. But still, though, it's a good spread. And as I found out, as I got a little bit further down this line of investigation, it's a little bit more complicated than that. So these are the end members that I ended up with. So talking about doing this backwards, but I'm going to talk about the bottom of the table first. So the orange row in the tables here are the organic end members. And I ended up using two. One value for the control plots, and that value includes root respiration. Autotrophic respiration is heavily depleted. So that's why this is a little bit more negative than the one I'm using for the disturbed plots, where the root respiration has been greatly curbed. And also in the disturbed profiles, we found that more decomposed organic matter was being metabolized, and that is a little bit more enriched. So two slightly different end members for control and disturbed plot. They're pretty close together, it's not so bad. And then for the carbonate end member, the first row of the table is the isotopic signature of the solid phase carbonate in the profile. It sits at around -4.2. We determined that by dissolving entirely in acid and measuring the signature of what comes out of it. And this could be a viable end member for what happens in the soil. You can picture a small carbonate grain hanging out in the A horizon, a drop of, not a drop, but a millimole of nitric acid falls on it because of nitrification. It goes all into solid phase. That could be happening. Another thing that could be happening, though, is that the carbonate-derived CO2 that we see being evolved by these soils is forming in equilibrium with a large dissolved carbonate pool, dissolved inorganic carbon pool. And it turns out that isotopic geochemistry is complicated. There's a fractionation between the liquid phase and the gas phase, which results in about 8 per mil separation of between the gas that evolves and dissolves in organic carbon pool. So long story short, we have these two possible end members for our inorganic carbon. That's where it's at right now. We'll come back to that. So these are the results that we got for our control plots. I have only the control plots on this graph. The x-axis is a sampling month that we sampled between May and September. And then on the y-axis, we have the isotopic signature of soil-derived CO2. And so we can see, well, we can see two things. We can see that, first of all, the isotopic signature tends to increase with time. It's lower in the spring than it is in the summer. And then the other thing is that even in the control plots, all the CO2 cannot be attributed solely to the organic end member. There is something else contributing to the signature of this CO2. And this is the same graph, and I've added the control, the disturbed results to the control. And so what we see is that during the spring, the disturbed plots usually have more enriched CO2 emissions than the control plots. In the summer, however, they kind of stay the same, so they end up overlapping. They end up not being significantly different from what we see in the control. And again, we can see that they are not. The signature does not reflect the organic matter end member. There is something else contributing to it. The something else, of course, being the inorganic carbon. So this is just the simple mixing model that we can use to try to quantify how much carbonate contribution is needed to explain these values that we observed. So we're using the observation, the DC13 of soil, and then the organic end member appropriate for either the control or the disturbed plot. And we're also using our inorganic end member. And I'll show you how it turns out with both options, the solid phase carbonate going fully into gas phase and the gas phase evolving from a dissolved inorganic carbon pool. So this is considering the inorganic end member being at -4.2. And this is what we find. We find that on the y-axis here, the proportion of CO2 originating from the organic sources. So it's most of it in the 90%. But we still, it's not 100%, and it's significantly different from 100%. So there is a significant detectable contribution of carbonates to emissions. And we also find that there are some differences between treatments. So differences between seasons, differences between treatments. So in the spring, the contribution of carbonate is much higher than in the control. And in the summer, the contribution of carbonate increases in the control, and this ends up being not significantly different from what is in the disturbed plot. This is the same plot, seemingly, using the minus 12 per mil inorganic members. So the good news is that the graphs look the same, the significant differences are the same, the axes are slightly shifted. So when, if my CO2 is evolved from a large dissolved inorganic pool, the contribution of carbonate, the calculated contribution of carbonate to soil efflux ends up being a little higher. But again, we see that it is lower, it's lower in the spring than it is in summer, and within the spring, it is, the contribution of carbonate is higher in disturbed than in control. So now trying to think about what this might mean in terms of the global biogeochemistry of the plot, this is what I've put together. And the interpretation of this is a little bit tricky. I had animations before, but I made a PDF and I killed them. So basically, this is, instead of just representing the proportion of carbon coming from inorganic sources, I'm showing you the flux attributable to carbonate sources. So don't pay attention to the percentage on top for now. Just look at the bars, and we can see that in the graph, in the spring, the flux attributable to the carbonate is quite low. In the summer, that increases. In this third plot, it's constant with season, and it's always high. It's as high as the highest that we see in summer in the control. Now, the percentage I have on top of the bar, I can confuse you a little bit further, is the same numbers expressed as a percentage of heterotrophic respiration, because we have a lot more decomposition in the disturbed plot. We have a lot more decomposition in the summer. So these are expressed as percentage heterotrophic. And we can see that it makes between 5 and 10% of the soil respiration. So we're not going to stay on that, not knowing what our inorganic end member is and not knowing what it means to our global carbon balance. We still have a little bit more work to do. It's in progress. One thing that we're doing is we're measuring the carbon C13 signature of the dissolved inorganic carbon pool, see what that's about. That's going to help us constrain whether most of the carbonate weathering is due to strong acid weathering or whether it's due to carbonic acid weathering. If the carbonic acid system is active, we've got another problem on our hand in that it consumes some CO2. Another thing we're doing is some incubation work to look at the role of the dissolved inorganic carbon pool and potential isotopic exchange between this pool and the gas phase. And then the third bullet would be that if we could detect change in soil carbonate, measuring the soil carbon pool in the soils at 5 years after disturbance. We have one plot that's been disturbed 5 years ago that's coming up for a deep soil carbon pool resampling. We're hoping to be able to actually detect something that is equivalent to the fluxes that we saw. We're hoping to be able to detect this in the soil carbon pools, hopefully. So I'll let you know how that turns out. So in summary, this is my, I had a high school intern working with me last year, and he got very much excited about the soil carbonates. And he would tell you that the carbonates make up a large proportion of the potentially reactive soil carbon pools. It's exciting that we can detect the contribution of the carbon pools to total soil carbon emissions at the plot scale. This is currently completely not taken into account in our carbon cycling models. That's something that we might want to think about, even though it only makes up, as far as I can tell right now, 5 to 10% of the carbon fluxes. These fluxes probably respond to very different drivers than the heterotrophic respiration fluxes. So that's something that we want probably to look into it a bit more. So I'd like to acknowledge my funding sources, particularly USDA and the Department of Energy, all these people that contributed to this. I don't know if we have time for questions.
Yep, we have time for a couple questions. Thank you very much.
That's a really good question. So you're right that the native vegetation would be a mixed forest, but these particular plots of land were deforested at least 100 years ago. So the idea is that it's sort of adjusted to the new land use, and it's a little bit misleading to say that growing these hybrid poplars is returning these soils to the original land use, because hybrid poplars are not a forest. They're, the soil is tilled. It's more of like an ag crop. The soil is tilled. There's pre-emergent herbicide. Weed is controlled for the next at least couple of years while the poplars get established. After the first rotation, they'll usually fertilize. It's very much an ag management, so it's not really putting the soil back onto the trajectory of the deciduous forest. But that's it's a really interesting thing to think about for sure.
In that context, then, I mean, what's the carbon? That's sort of the caging off the natural forest. How would that compare?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't have soils from the original forest, and I'm assuming that the earthworms would probably control it. But yeah, if you have the litter layer, probably generates quite a bit of acidity, which could potentially leach the carbonate from that top layer. But if you do have earthworms that are continuously churning things up from the mineral soil, you could maintain this carbonate layer, small carbonate concentration above the expected weathering front. That's one thing. That, I mean, I didn't measure earthworms, so that the carbonate concentration in the topsoil seemed very correlated to the abundance of earthworms in the profile. So an interesting question at the interaction of vegetation, earthworms, and other things.
Very interesting. Thank you very much, Stephanie.
Thank you.